White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the 21st episode of the International Jew Study Hour. It is November 15th, 2012, and we are beginning Chapter 17 this evening, and a fabulous chapter it is, titled, Does Jewish Power Control the World Press? Do you think so, huh? This is something that we know, we absolutely know today. The questions was being asked in 1920, and some people were aware of it then, and it was already true then. So why is it that so many people still deny it today? I'm Carolyn Yeager, and here with me is my co-host, Hadding Scott.
Yes,
do you have an answer to that,
Hadding?
What? Do you have an answer to that question?
Well, I think Jews pretty well dominate mass media in the United States and in Britain through direct control, for the most part. In the rest of the world, the grip is not quite that firm.
Yeah, but my question was, why are there so many people who still deny it today when it's so clear? You know, it's so clear that they do. I mean, you can hardly deny it, and yet people still do. What, you know, regular people, European people. Well, my answer to that is because they're under the control of Jewish power, and the power of the press to say that they can't say that, even though it's so clear.
In Germany today, the mass media is not under Jewish control. That's my understanding from talking to a friend of mine that is German and lives there, and the people who own the press today are not Jews. However, they are subject to prodding from Jewish organizations.
Well, that's right, and they're communists too, and they're business people that go along with whatever. So even though they're not Jews so much in Germany, you're right. They still deny that Jews control the media. So there's this denial keeps going on, even though it's so obvious. That was just the point that I was making. And we'll be talking about that in this chapter and one or two more chapters after this. A big, big topic. Before we start, I want to bring attention to a currently active internet organization called FAIR. You're probably familiar with it.
FAIR. Fairness and accuracy in reporting. That's like
right.
The wing equivalent of accuracy in media.
Right. And they've been around since 1986 and perhaps envisioning the growth of the internet. I don't know. But they call themselves a national media watch group. And at one time, I thought I had liberal friends and this was talked about and, you know, recommended and so on. Oh, they do such a great job. They check out all the reporting that's being done and they make sure it's fair and accurate. Oh, yeah, sure. You know, this organization exemplifies how the Jewish world plan operates, if you ask me, if we go by what is being talked about in this chapter. Mm. There are others, of course, but this one is really perfect as an example of what I would call a subversive Jewish-run media watchdog that pretends to be, you know, fair and balanced, so to speak. But, of course, is
Fair and balanced, that's the Fox News thing. They're fair
I know, I know, but I'm just making a joke there. But, okay, we'll call it fair and accurate. They're pretending to be fair and accurate, but they are really...
Watchdog!
What they're really doing, yeah, is making sure that is directing... away from blaming the Jews for anything.
Yeah,
and you can see them doing it.
House and a watchdog.
What?
More like a fox guarding the hen house than a watchdog.
There you go. But of course, they call themselves a watchdog. And so I'm going to, if you will allow me, I'm going to read just the last two short paragraphs of their About Us on their website. And the best way to get to that website is just to Google FAIR something like that, and you'll come up with it. So, first let's start with this. They write, for an in-depth explanation of FAIR's critique of the mainstream media, you should start with our overview, What's Wrong with the News? You might also check out the article, What's FAIR? By FAIR founder Jeff Cohen. See, I found it right there. And see what journalists, activists, and scholars have to say about FAIR. Well, those things are all linked to some articles they have. But, when I looked at About Us, I didn't see it. So this is the last paragraph of what they have written there. And I thought, well, they're not saying who is behind this until I got down here, and they did mention his name. And actually, he's a Cohen. You know, he's one of the real elite Jews. Because Cohen means the priest class.
Right.
And they're the highest, and so. And the last paragraph just says, you know, just to get an idea of this, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting Incorporated, FAIR, is a registered 501c3 nonprofit organization. FAIR's federal tax-exempt ID number is blah, blah. Donations to FAIR are fully tax-deductible. So, you know, they think they're doing this great work that people should be donating to them, but a special interest how I found this was or came upon it. I was aware of it, but I don't ever go and look at it. Is a 1996 article they have on their site called "The Jewish Media: The Lie That Won't Die," and that's what they're saying, you know. And it's people should go and read that because it's all there. It's all there according to what's in the chapter that we're going to talk about tonight. And they call the idea that Jews run the media an old canard. And they mention Henry Ford and the protocols and William Pierce and many others. And it's written by a professor from Johns Hopkins University. But he uses such insults and slurs and, the words that he chooses to call people, the descriptive words. I don't have those in front of me right now, but. It's really amazing. I mean, you know, just really insulting to everybody. He even brings up Pat Buchanan and just about everyone, you know. And then this is supposed to be FAIR and accurate. It's really incredible. But a lot of their other stuff that doesn't do with where they're trying to protect the Jews and these attacks on Jews might appear to be, you see. So this is going to fit in with some of the things that we're going to read in this chapter. So that's why I wanted to bring that up.
Yeah. Usually they like to say, what about Ted? They used to like to say, what about Ted Turner?
Yeah, they bring Ted Turner up. He's supposed to be one. They say, oh, there's all these wasps in publishing.
Yeah,
and they start naming them. And Ted Turner's one of them.
He bought him up. He used to have his media empire, and he doesn't have that anymore. They got taken over by Jews.
That's right. That's right. This is 1996, so it's interesting to read it to see what they were saying back then, and how it's even worse today than it was then. There were a few people then that you could point to, but it's really amazing. And I think that this is one of those Jewish organizations that are talked about in this chapter that are set up to confuse people and to misdirect people and to be the opposition. You know, that they're supposed to be the ones that are trying to be FAIR when they're really, if you study the whole site, I'm sure, just pro-Jewish. And they don't mention Jews unless it's to defend them in ways like this. Otherwise, they would never mention them.
All right.
Okay.
Are we going to start now?
Yes.
Chapter 17, Does Jewish Power Control the World Press? The purpose of this article is twofold, to set forth what the protocols have to say about the relation of the press to the world program, and to make an introduction to a study of Jewish influence on the press. The Jewish race has always been aware of the advantages to be derived from news. This was one of the factors in its control of European commerce from the earliest Christian times. To be informed beforehand, to know what was coming before the Gentiles among whom they lived knew it, was a special privilege of the Jews, made possible by the close communication in which widely separated Jewish groups kept themselves. From the first, they were inveterate correspondents. They were the inventors of the newsletter. This does not imply, however, that the Jews were the forerunners or even the sponsors of the modern press. It was no part of their purpose to distribute news among the people, but to keep it for themselves as a secret advantage. The political, economic, and commercial news, which sped with really remarkable facility throughout Europe, from Jewish community to Jewish community, was in reality the official budget by which each community was informed, by which each community informed all the others of what was transpiring as to war, trade currents, rising emergencies, or whatever the matter may have been. For centuries, the Jews were the best informed people on the continent, from their secret sources in courts and chancelleries, from privileged Jews who were placed in every position of vantage. The whole race was informed of the state of the world.
You know, having this brought to my mind, I go back to Elie Wiesel, the way Elie Wiesel insists in his writings that the poor people of Sziget and all these poor Hungarians didn't know, had never heard of Auschwitz, didn't know anything that was going on, and they went along with that. They got on those trains and they did all that because they didn't know where they were going. They believed what they were told. But, you know, that doesn't fit at all with this idea that these Jews always know everything that's going on. And, of course, they knew about that. So,
well, the BBC was broadcast and dropping, and RAF was dropping leaflets telling people stories about what was going on in Auschwitz and so forth. That was the reason for the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, in fact.
Well, maybe they didn't drop them in Sziget, Hungary.
No, maybe not.
Yeah.
Scouts were kept in motion everywhere. Far down in South America, before the British or Dutch colonies in North America had hardly secured a foothold, there were Jews who served as outposts for European trade interests. The world was spied out in the interests of their race. Just as today, the entire planet is under the watchful eyes of Jewish agents, mostly Gentiles, it must be said, for any hint of new gold discoveries.
Well, see, even then they knew that the agents and all these Gentiles were working for the Jews.
An interesting and historic illustration of the Jews' appreciation of news is to be found in the career of Nathan Rothschild. Rothschild had laid all his plans on the assumption that the Emperor Napoleon, then banished to Elba, was finally eliminated from European affairs. Napoleon unexpectedly returned, and in the 100 days, it seemed as if the Rothschild financial edifice might collapse. Feverishly, the financier aided both Prussia and England, and as the Battle of Waterloo approached, no one was more interested in the outcome than he. Rothschild was a man who shrank from the sight of blood. He was physically a coward, and any sign of violence unnerved him. But so intense was his interest in the battle on which his whole fortune seemed to depend, that he hastened to France, followed the British army, and when the battle began, he hid himself in some shot-proof nook near Hougomont, where he watched all day the ebb and flow of battle. Just before Napoleon ordered the last desperate charge, Rothschild had made up his mind. He said afterward that his exclamation at this point was, "The House of Rothschild has won the battle." He hurried from the field, galloped wildly to Brussels, communicating not a word of what he knew to the anxious people he met by the way. Hiring a carriage at an exorbitant price, he galloped away to Ostend. Here a fierce storm was raging on the ocean, and no sailor was willing to set out for England about 20 miles away. Rothschild himself, always afraid of danger, forgot his fear in his visions of the stock market. He offered 500, 800, and at length 1,000 francs to the man who would take him across, but no one dared. Finally, one sailor proposed that if Rothschild would pay 2,000 francs into his wife's hands, he would attempt it. Half dead, the two men reached the English coast, but without rest, Rothschild ordered express post and hurried away to London. Whip and spur were not spared on that journey. There were no telegrams in those days, no swift communication. England was anxious. The rumors were bad. And on the morning of June 20th, 1815, when Nathan Rothschild appeared in his usual place at the Stock Exchange and leaned against the column, England knew nothing of what he knew. He was pale and broken. The sight of his face led the other financiers to believe that he had received bad news from the front. Then it was seen that he was quietly selling his securities. What? Rothschild unloading? The market dropped disastrously. A very panic seized the financiers. The market was flooded with consols offered for sale. And all that was offered, Rothschild's agents bought. So it went on all day the 20th and all day the 21st. At the close of business the second day, Rothschild's heavy chests were crammed with securities. Then in the evening, a courier galloped into London with the news that Wellington had won and Napoleon was a fugitive. But Nathan Rothschild had made 10 million pounds, and the men he did business with had lost that much. All as an affair of news. There was a little incident in Washington during the war, a leak of news it was called. The wise men of Wall Street sometimes whisper that even between 1914 and 1918, there were men of Rothschild's race who showed his same appreciation of news with the same profitable results. And not only the men of Rothschild's race, but some of their Gentile fronts also.
Hey, you know, speaking of this Rothschild and all that he went through to manage to make that big coup, you know, it brings out how, well, Henry Ford's always talking about this special energy that Jews have, and other people talk about it too. This intense energy that they can put forth in going after their goals and so on. And he certainly exemplified that at the time. I mean, he recognized what he was after and he put everything into it.
Well, it's reminiscent of every Jewish joke, you know, like how was copper wire invented? Two Jews fighting over a penny, right? But
okay.
Yeah, he would go to great
lengths
for money. There was money there involved. There were times during the war when no Gentile knew what was going on in certain countries. The Jewish leaders always knew. Some very interesting testimony can be presented on that point. Aside from its own interest, this Rothschild narrative fully illustrates the statement that while the Jews were very early news gatherers, they were not publicists. They used the news for their own benefit. They did not disseminate it. If it had depended on their influence, there would have been no public press at all. It was in France, which had no newspapers outside the capital, that the French Revolution was possible. There being no reliable exchange of news and opinion, the people were kept in ignorance. Paris itself did not know that the Bastille had fallen until the next day. Where there is no press, minorities easily gain control, just as the Jewish Bolshevist Revolution in Russia illustrates.
That's pretty interesting. I never would have particularly thought of that, you know, what they're pointing out here. So what we know, a free press, a good press is really so important, but it's been waylaid, hasn't it? So we don't
have the internet now.
Yeah, that's right. How important that is. Yeah.
Yeah, I can remember reading about the ADL complaining about the internet and all the stuff that people were saying on internet, and the issue of pornography suddenly came up around 1994 thereabouts. So we got to do something about pornography on the internet. It's terrible.
Well, we should though.
Well,
we should though.
But you see, the thing is, what they piggyback on
they might want to do that, but still, they invented all that pornography, and now they want to use it, I guess. But we should see through all that, and we should get rid of not only the pornography but the Jews.
But you know that a lot of that filtering software that came out around that time to protect children in, you know, school libraries and protect people in public libraries sometimes from seeing pornography, it also filters out anything with words like nigger.
Well, you know, I think children do need to be protected. And I think in libraries it's perfectly okay to not be people to go in a library and look at pornography. Now, if all that happens is that they filter out the word nigger for people who want to say that to each other, well, that's not a problem for me. You know, I mean, there's a place for things. We can't just have total freedom.
Yes, well, they have some racial websites that are listed along with the pornography. That's my point.
Yeah. Most of us aren't affected by that. But if we are, well, people don't, you know, can't get everything at the library. You know, I mean, you can have one at home when you don't have that going on. Okay.
One of the most dangerous developments of the time is public distrust of the press. If the day ever comes when swift, reliable, and authoritative communication with the entire people shall be necessary for public action in the interests of public safety, the nation may find itself sadly crippled unless a new confidence in the daily press can be built up. If for no other reason than that a free press is a safeguard against minority seizure of control, such laws as the zone laws or any restrictions on the freest and fullest communication between various parts of the country should be absolutely abolished.
Well, we can't do without distrust of the press now, because we can't trust the press at all. So that's gone, you know.
That's an overstatement.
But you know, the fact is that the fear of the question about Jewish control of the press, I say again, I mean, the Jews have control of the press, period. And that what we're getting is what they want us to get when we go there. You can find some things.
I've done a lot of research in newspapers, and what I find is that news reports usually are accurate, more or less. I mean, it's not obvious that in news reports that they tried to skew the facts. Very often where you will find most of the distortion is in the editorial pages. And of course, if you listen to some of these guys on AM radio, you know, it's all spin. But
yeah,
what you can do, if you go back to the first reports about some event, you'll find honesty there, because when something has just happened, they don't know yet what it is that they're supposed to filter out.
So it's the editors. It's the editors who are behind making these adjustments. And the reporters might be wanting to report things as they saw them, and they put in their report. But then later they have to accept that they've been changed by the editors, and they can't complain about it or they'll lose their job, so they accept it. So in that way, they're.
Well, let me give you a specific example. When I was researching the story about Saddam Hussein, that he had gassed, 100,000 or whatever number of Kurdish civilians, I found out that the only instance where anybody had claimed to see any gassed Kurds at Al-Halabja was reported in the New York Times. And what the first report that appeared about it in the New York Times said was that the Iranians were the ones that had put out the claim that the Iraqis had gassed those people. And it said that reporters who went to the scene only saw 100 or so dead bodies. Later on, there was this claim put out that there were 5,000 there. And the fact that it was the Iranians that had made the accusation wasn't discussed anymore. See, that's how you get to the root of things, by going to the early reports on something.
I didn't dispute that. I agree with that.
All right. So you can carry distrust of the press a little too far. Usually you can get some information in there if you're skeptical, if you're critical. But the press, being in existence and being largely an Anglo-Saxon creation, it is a force not to be treated lightly. And that is the point where the world program and Jewish control come in contact with it.
Yeah, so I thought that was interesting. The press, they call it an Anglo-Saxon creation, largely. I guess that's probably true.
Huh? Yeah.
No. They didn't create printing. That was the Gutenberg press, but that's not the press we're talking about. We're talking about the news press.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of interesting.
The protocols, which overlook nothing, propose a very definite plan with regard to the press. As in the multitude of other matters with which these remarkable documents deal, there are two phases: what we have done and what we will do. As early as the second protocol, the press comes in for attention. It is significant that it makes its appearance in the same protocol in which the No Annexations program was announced 20 years before the World War, in the same protocol in which it is announced that Gentile rulers will be allowed to appear before the people for a short period, while Jewish influences were organizing themselves behind the scenes of seats of power, and in the same protocol where Darwinism, Marxism, and Nietzscheism are claimed among the most demoralizing doctrines which Jewish influence has disseminated. These are very curious statements, but not stranger than the actuality that has come to pass.
Okay.
Says the second protocol, Shmueli.
There is one great force in the hands of modern governments which creates thought movements among the people, that is, the press. The presumed role of the press is to indicate supposedly indispensable needs, to register popular complaints, and to create discontent. The triumph of free speech, in other words, babbling, rests in the press. But governments are unable to profit by this power, and it has fallen into our hands. Through it, we have attained influence while remaining in the shadows. Thanks to it, we have amassed gold, though it has cost us torrents of blood and tears.
In the same protocol, our press is spoken of as the agency through which are disseminated those theories of life which we have induced them, the Gentiles, to regard as the dictates of science.
To this end, we shall certainly endeavor to inspire blind confidence in these theories by means of our press.
Then follows the claim made concerning the three most revolutionary theories in the physical, economic, and moral realms, namely Darwinism, Marxism, and Nietzscheism. In the third protocol, the claim is made that this control of the press is being used to break down respect for authority.
Daring journalists and audacious pamphleteers make daily attack upon the personnel of the administration. This abuse of authority is definitely preparing the downfall of all institutions, and everything will be overturned by blows coming from the infuriated populace.
Again, in the seventh protocol, discussing the progress by which the world program has already made, the part played by the press is indicated.
We must force the Gentile governments to adopt measures which will promote our broadly conceived plan, already approaching its triumphal goal, by bringing to bear the pressure of stimulated public opinion, which has in reality been organized by us with the help of the so-called great power of the press. With few exceptions not worth considering, it is already in our hands.
Thus twice is the claim made to control of the press. It has fallen into our hands, says the second protocol. It is already in our hands, says the seventh. In the second protocol, the press is represented as furthering revolutionary physical, economic, and moral philosophies, while in the seventh it is used to create the pressure of stimulated public opinion for the purpose of forcing Gentile governments to adopt measures which will promote our broadly conceived plan already approaching its triumphant goal. A word of comment may be made here upon the claim of the second protocol that, thanks to it, the press, we have amassed gold, though it has cost us torrents of blood and tears. This is a statement which can be illustrated in many ways. Though it has cost us torrents of blood and tears is an admission upon which the protocols throw light, a light which also shines upon the Jewish argument regarding responsibility for the recent war, namely that Jewish world financial power could not have willed the war, seeing that Jews suffered so heavily in Eastern Europe. The protocols frankly recognize the possibility of Jews suffering during the establishment of the world program, but it consoles them with the thought that they fall as soldiers for the good of Israel. The death of a Jew, we are told in the protocols, is more precious in the sight of God than the death of 1,000 seed of cattle, which is one of the delicate names applied to the Gentiles.
Hey, you know, what they're saying here is also said in the Talmud. So that makes a pretty good connection.
Well, sure.
This and that. And, of course, this idea that they sacrifice some Jews, even though they believe in these, because it's in the Talmud, and in the Bible and in other places, the Torah, that that a Jew's life is worth, you know, 1,000 lives of others, non-Jews and so on, that they should not sacrifice Jewish lives, but their goal, their overall goal is supreme, and that takes precedence, and Jews then who do fall, who do die in pursuit of this, who are sacrificed or whatever. They say, well, they die as soldiers for the greater good of Israel and so on. And that's the way they deal with it. And they deal with it that way, it's apparently everywhere, you know, in all these, groups.
Yeah.
'Cause they're saying that here too.
Well, you know, the head of the World Zionist Congress, was around the time of World War II. Weizmann, he said that he would rather see all of the Jews of Israel of Germany die of some disease rather than to give up on Palestine as a homeland for the Jews.
Yeah, and I think he said something, or one of them said that the Jews who weren't fit to come to Israel could be sacrificed. Because the ones who were fit enough to come to Israel, and they only wanted fit Jews too to come to
Israel. He probably said Palestine, though.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, he didn't say Israel. He wouldn't have said Israel at that time. But
the reference to the amassment of gold is very clear. It does not apply to ownership of publications and a share in their profits only, but also the use that may be made of them through silence or outcry to promote international Jewish financiers' schemes. The Rothschilds bought editors as they bought legislators. It was a preliminary of nearly every scheme they floated to first fix the newspapers, either for silence or clack boosting. In matters of war and peace, in the removal of administrations inimical to Jewish financial or political plans, in the elimination of public exposure of Gentile fronts whom their Jewish masters wished to be rid of, in the gradual building up of reputation and influence for rising men who had been chosen for work in the future. In these and like matters, the press very greatly aided the international cabal in attaining its end.
Yeah, this clack boosting would be like cheerleading. You either stay quiet about it, or you cheerlead, you know, in the right direction. That's how they fix the newspapers.
Yeah, I remember the rise of Carl Sagan. He had this series on PBS called Cosmos.
Mm-hmm. You know, I do too.
Which was in itself, I guess, innocuous and harmless and maybe even beneficial, educational. But they made a celebrity out of him with that series. And then he became a spokesman on other things where his influence was not so innocuous.
Really? He's Jewish, huh?
I believe so.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, they did. I can remember. You know, this guy became like the greatest person in the world for a while. You know, see how they can do that. And then they wanted him to make statements about other things to boost their, you know, their interests. Interesting.
All the details of the foregoing paragraph can be illustrated at length by instances which have occurred in the United States within the past 15 years. There was once a senator of the United States who, but that story illustrates another point also and will be reserved until that point is reached in this series of discussions. He started to say that and then decided he wasn't going to say it now.
But I think they're doing that for effect, or they didn't have to add it there. But they wanted the kind of a teaser that there's a senator of the United States.
Saying, you might remember something about a senator.
Yeah.
We'll get into that later.
Yeah.
The 12th protocol, however, contains the entire plan of control of the press, reaching from the present time into the future when the Jewish world government shall be established. The reader is invited to read carefully and thoughtfully the deep and wide outreaching of this plan. Keep also in mind the boast that has been made for generations, that no publication that has handled the Jewish question in a manner distasteful to the Jewish powers has been allowed to live.
That's pretty powerful. No publication is still alive. You know?
Go Shmuley.
Okay. What role is played at present by the press? It serves to inflame the passions of selfish partisanship, which our interests require. It is shallow, lying, and unfair. The most people do not understand what end it serves.
In that quotation, we have the same low estimate, which was noted when we studied the estimate of human nature, which the protocols contain. Now for the plan of press control. We separate the points for convenience.
We shall handle the press in the following manner.
One,
we shall saddle it and keep tight rein upon it. We shall do the same also with other printed matter. For of what use is it to rid ourselves of attacks in the press if we remain exposed to criticism through pamphlets and books?
Two,
not one announcement will reach the people save under our supervision. We have attained this at the present time to the extent that all news is received through several agencies in which it is centralized from all parts of the world. Well, what do we have now? We have AP, Reuters, which is Jewish. And
yeah,
we
Reuters
all are,
Jew.
But Reuters is definitely Jewish. And we used to be UPI, but I don't think that exists anymore.
UPI still exists.
Does it? You never see it. All I see is AP, and Reuters is really big.
Yeah.
But anyway, there you go. Those are those news outlets, news services. Is there another one?
There's also New York Times Wire Service.
Okay.
Yeah.
We know what to expect from them.
A sidelight on the first sentence above may be had from this Jewish statement regarding the British Declaration relating to Palestine. That's the Balfour Declaration.
Okay. This declaration was sent from the Foreign Office to Lord Walter Rothschild. It came perhaps as a surprise to large sections of the Jewish people, but to those who are active in Zionist circles, the declaration was no surprise. The wording of it came from the British Foreign Office, but the text had been revised in the Zionist offices of America as well as in England. The British declaration was made in the form in which the Zionists desired it. This is page
85 and 86 in the Guide to Zionism by Jesse E. Sampter, published by the Zionist Organization of America. And I'm glad to know what the source of that information is, because I read that a long time ago in a pamphlet called The Balfour Declaration Warrant for Genocide by a guy named Conrad Grebe. And I never knew what the source was, and now it's a Jewish source. Now I know it's reliable.
Okay.
Number three.
That's pretty shocking, too, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's just another part
of the Balfour Declaration.
The Jews managed to approve or disapprove of everything that goes out.
The Balfour Declaration was the promise. It was the incentive for Jews in the United States to agitate for the United States to come into the First World War.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, a lot hinged on that.
Mm-hmm.
The British tried to renege on it after the First World War. They decided that the letting Palestine, well, there were a lot of problems from Jews coming in there, and then they put a halt to it.
Well, I read that they thought that they could go along with it in order to get, like you say, America into the war and all these things
they wanted.
Right. And then they thought that after the war they could just throw it away. And they found out that the Jews were damn more powerful already than maybe they were before the war. And they couldn't do it anymore. They couldn't do anything like that. This is how we underestimate these Jews who are way ahead in their thinking, because people who are used to having power, like the British were, don't think they can lose it. But
well, you know, making a promise like the Balfour Declaration is kind of like signing an agreement to borrow money and pay interest on it. They're going to want their payment. They're going to want their pound of flesh because you signed, right?
Mm-hmm.
Number three, Shmuley.
What does Shmuley mean? That's just a name, huh?
That's like a Jewish... That's like the nickname version of Samuel.
Okay. All right. That's okay.
Like Shmuley Boteach.
I kind of like it. Literature and journalism are two most important educational forces, and consequently our government will become the owner of most of the journals. If we permit 10 private journals, we shall organize 30 of our own, and so on. This must not be suspected by the public, for which reason all the journals published by us will be externally of the most contrary opinions, externally, they say, and tendencies, thus evoking confidence in them and attracting our unsuspecting opponents, who thus will be caught in our trap and rendered harmless.
Yes,
well, you know, a lot of this that's being said does fit this thing I mentioned, this FAIR organization, but that's only one of so many. I mean, we see them doing this, you know. We know that they do this. And when we say they take both sides of the issue, you know, they're doing that on everything. They're on all sides. And
not all sides. You know, for example, in the Russian Revolution, you know, there were Jewish bourgeois liberals, there were Jewish communists, there were Jewish socialists. There were no Jewish monarchists so far.
Yeah, but I'm talking about right now. Now I think they might have somebody everywhere.
Yeah.
And
If there are any Jews in white nationalism, they're probably advocating things that are really counterproductive.
Yeah. Yeah, well, but, you know, they might be pretty clever. You know, they have all those agents amongst the right wing in Germany, which is causing them problems in doing anything about it because...
Government. Those agents, I think.
Yeah, government agents. Those are government agents. I know that. I didn't mean to confuse the two things,
right.
But I did. So we're talking about Jewish agents. All right.
Okay. This is most interesting in view of the defense now being made by so many Jewish journals. Look at the newspapers owned and controlled by Jews, they say. See how they differ in policy. See how they disagree with each other. Certainly, externally, as Protocol 12 says, but the underlying unity is never hard to find.
Yeah, now that's another thing. We need to just, you know, make sure people heard that this is what they say now. They say, oh, look at all the differences of opinions among Jews. Well, they say that on the Internet now, you know. We hear that a lot. Well, you've got Jews on. Now there's this guy, Paul Eisen, who unfortunately, Santamaro is now just posting his stuff like crazy. He's a Jew, and because he's one of the more...
Santamaro or Eisen?
Eisen is a Jew.
Okay, yeah, I don't want to say that Santamaro is a Jew.
No, I don't want to say that. But, you know, whenever a Jew appears to be friendly to a, you know, or, you know, critical of the Jews, Santa Maro just thinks that's great. You know, that's not my, the way I see it. But anyway, you know, he could be, who knows how sincere he is. They put these people on the other side, to take, the, well, they're going to explain why they do it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Besides.
Well, I mean, when a Jew says, comes out and finally criticizes Jews, you know, it does actually kind of carry more weight with most people.
But it shouldn't, because we're fooled by that all the time. I think that's a mistake for us.
Well,
to
it's perfectly
that.
Natural
oh,
that it would carry
Look
more weight.
But he says that.
It's perfectly natural.
That doesn't work for me. It doesn't work for me. I'm too anti-Jewish.
I mean, you don't have to make the Jew the leader of your movement, but, you know, it does carry more weight rhetorically.
How do you know how sincere they are? And they all remain Jews in the end, and they want what the Jews want. They all do. When, if you would talk to them and get down to the nitty-gritty, if you could manage to do that, if they would let you, and not always be, you know, slippering around, you find that they still believe in Israel. They still want all this stuff, and they still want to be all over the world. They just think that they should get along with the Gentiles better.
Well, what about Brother Nathaniel?
I don't know about him. He is Jewish, and I wouldn't trust him in my organization. I mean, I wouldn't. I think the only way to be safe is to. I think he believes what he's. I don't know. You know, how do I know? But you know, I don't. He does what appears to be good work. But I think that we should never allow Jews in our organizations. I don't care how great they seem to be.
His persona is kind of strange to me, and I'm not sure that he puts a good face on what he's doing.
Well, yeah, and you know what bothers me is that increasingly on his website, he started this foundation. Whenever you start a foundation, it's because you're after money, and he all over his website, he's got his donate things, you know, and donate to the foundation, Brother Nathaniel Foundation.
Yeah.
What the hell is he doing with that foundation?
Well, he's taking money away from you.
Well, yeah, I am. But I know a lot of people send money to him. I know he's so popular because of this same theory that you just brought up, that people think, oh, he's a Jew. He's doing so much good for us. In the beginning, I really liked him because I heard him on some radio shows, and he can really talk about the Jews. Great, you know. He just sounds great exposing what they're like. But then as I saw the way he operates more and more, I don't know. Just be wary.
At some level, he remains still a Jew.
Yeah.
Besides, one way of discovering who are the people that have knowledge of the Jewish world problem, or who can be convinced of it, or who will write about it, is just to start a paper which externally seems to be independent on the Jewish question. So deeply is this thought shared by even uneducated Jews that a rumor today is widespread in the United States that the reason for the present series of articles in the Dearborn Independent is the desire of its owner to forward the Jewish World Program. Unfortunately, this scheme of starting a fake opposition in order to discover where the real opposing forces lie is not confined to the Jewish internationalists, although there is every indication that it was learned from them.
Okay, so we're talking about, what are we talking about here? Starting a fake opposition.
Yeah.
And that's what they do to find out where, to see who goes there and what they're saying and so on, and monitoring all of that. They're busy doing stuff like this all the time. There's no way you can trust what Jews are doing or... you just can't.
Yeah. This idea of a misrepresentative front for certain secret purposes is expressed at length, not only with reference to the press, but throughout the protocols in other relations. But in Protocol 12, it is fully developed with regard to the press, as the following quotations show. A. In order to force writers into such long productions that no one will read them, a tax on writing is proposed. on books of less than 30 pages a double tax. Such small articles are most feared. Therefore, doubly tax the pamphlets of less than 30 pages. The longer articles, fewer will read, so the protocols argue, and the double tax will thus force writers into such long productions that they will be little read, especially as they will be expensive.
Okay, I want to ask about this because I don't know anything about these taxes. Was there such a tax? I don't understand what the tax is.
Yeah, I've never heard of that, but I can tell you that Kevin MacDonald's books initially were only available in expensive library editions.
Why?
Well, Dr. Pierce's opinion was that this was to keep people from reading them.
Well, yeah, sure, but who could impose such a thing as that? I mean, do they have some control over the printers and so on? That's what they seem to be saying.
Well, it's Prager Publishing. I think Prager might be a Jewish name.
Oh, boy. Well, and, you know, bringing up Kevin MacDonald, I would like to say here that congratulations to you, Hadding, on having another article of yours published at the Occidental Observer. I think it went up, was it yesterday or the day before? And so those of you who are look at the Occidental Observer should take a look at that and see what you think of it. It's not about any of this stuff that we're talking about today. But, okay, I've got a protocol here to read.
Yes,
I was going to say, yeah, you know, the they point out here that short articles are the most effective, and that long articles, few people will read. That's so true.
Yeah, ordinary
and it makes me think even of comic books. What is the most easy to read in comic books? And they control all the comic books.
Yeah.
That's not just a short article, but that's something that, you know, anybody can read. So you get more people reading, maybe. All right, protocol from Protocol 12. That which we ourselves shall publish for directing the public mind will be cheap and widely read. Comic books. The tax will discourage mere literary ambition, whereas the fear of punishment will make the writer subservient to us. Even if there should be those who may desire to write against us, no one will publish their writings. How many American writers know this?
Yes. How many American writers know this?
Yeah.
Continue, Shmuley.
Before accepting any work for printing, the publisher or printer must obtain permission from the authorities. Thus, we will know in advance what attacks are being prepared against us and shall be able to counteract them by coming out beforehand with explanations on the subject. That's you, I think. Yeah, I'm done.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, this is not applicable today, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I find this kind of hard to follow. I don't know where this works out.
I think this may have been true in 19th century Prussia, something like this. They had things limited to. They had a certain degree of censorship about the. Rabble-rousing material, but
okay.
Anyway, none of this stuff is applicable here today. None of that is, that particular paragraph. That is largely the situation today in 1920, says mm-hmm. Ford. They do know in advance what is being done, and they do seek to disarm it beforehand. Here are the 3 degrees of Jewish journalism, which are not only stated in the protocols, but are observable in the everyday world. Oh, you know what? If by authorities was meant, you know, authorities being notified in advance, if it means the ADL, well, they have in the past tried to suppress publications. The most famous incident was Conquest of a Continent by Madison Grant. They sent out letters asking bookstores not to carry it.
Oh, yeah. You know, that ADL, they are so proactive. They're not ashamed of anything. They just go after everything they can go after. We still need to have something like that on our side. But they have this huge budget.
Here are the 3 degrees of Jewish journalism, which are not only stated in the protocols, but are observable in the everyday world of the present.
The leading place will be held by organs of an official character. Okay, organs of an official character. They will always stand guard over our interests, and consequently, their influence will be comparatively small. We have to ask what these organs of official character would be. What would these be? Government things or something like that? I'm asking you, Hattie.
I guess that would be like a government publication.
That's what I thought. Okay. All right, then it goes on. The second place will be held by semi-official organs whose aim it will be to attract the indifferent and lukewarm. Well, I don't know what that is either. But then, in the third category, we shall place organs of apparent opposition. At least one will be extremely antagonistic. Our true opponents will mistake this seeming opposition as belonging to their own group and will thus show us their cards.
This kind of seems to fit more with Napoleon III than with the Jews, because he actually had a government and he could put out organs of an official, he could have organs of an official character and also have a false opposition. Jews normally are not in a position to do that.
Well, it is a little hard to follow this, and maybe this was a part that was taken from there.
Yeah.
I beg you to notice that among those who attack us, there will be organs founded by us, organs, and they will attack exclusively those points which we plan to change or eliminate. All our papers will support most diverse opinions, aristocratic, republican, even anarchist, so long, of course, as the Constitution lives. Now, maybe that says something, because I've got a little note here. Consider here that Joly, a supposed monarchist, but actually a Freemason, wrote something like the protocols, maybe under the tutelage of Premieu. Well, that takes some explaining there. But he says that these diverse opinions, well, we have that today, but the way these words are used are a little strange, but because we don't think in terms of aristocrats, maybe even in 19... Well, but this is from the protocols, so the protocols did, yeah. And so, you know, they're always support. They're always in. Again, we say they're into all sides of the issue. So to continue this, I don't have much time. These fools.
These fools who believe. This is the quotation. Go ahead.
Is this part of me? Well.
Go ahead.
These fools who believe they are repeating the opinions expressed by their party newspapers will be repeating our opinions or those things which we wish them to think. Yeah, that's part of the protocol. So I don't know if I can finish this part. By always discussing and contradicting our writings superficially and without touching upon their essence, our press will keep up a blank fire against the official newspapers, only to give us opportunity to express ourselves in greater detail than we could in our first declaration. This will be done when useful to us. Attacks.
I think the fact that they talk about superficial and contradictory discussion means that what you have to do is read critically.
Of course, if we all read critically, we'd be a whole lot better off, and they probably count on the fact that people don't read critically, and they don't. So we have run out of time. I knew we wouldn't finish this, ladies and gentlemen, and we will finish it next week, and see where we go from there. Maybe we'll go.
Rage, rage, I'm breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.